Hey, Black and Published family, it's Nikisha. I want to say thank you for rocking with me these last few years. Over the course of these 5 seasons, I've shared with you the journeys of countless writers, including myself. I've told you about starting out as a self-published author and when my first nonfiction book came out in 2022. I have a new novel coming out in January entitled The 7 Daughters of Dupree. The story is a generational epic about the secrets kept between mothers and daughters over the course of 7 generations, told backwards in time from 1995 to 1860, and it's available for pre-order now, everywhere you get your books. I am beyond excited for this novel. It is my first Big 5 book, more on that later, and I'd like to make it a success, and I need your help to do that. If you can, please consider pre-ordering The 7 Daughters of Dupree today. Now let's get to the episode.
People don't truly know what I'm working with, okay? I think the critics knew, right? The critics knew. Oh, this is a deep intellect we are witnessing.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published on the Mahogany Books Podcast Network, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. We have a return guest to the show today, Ms. Honoree Fanon Jeffers. She's back with her latest book, Misbehaving at the Crossroads, Essays and Writings. The book blends history, cultural criticism, and memoir seamlessly to weave a story about Black women in America, their worth, their value, and their inherent humanity and equality.
Who's doing all of that? Who's nurturing this environment? That is the invisible labor of Black women. And so when I began thinking about that, I began thinking about enslaved Black women and how so much of us is ignored. And then I started connecting that to myself.
The book unravels Ms. Honoree's own personal history and her complex and complicated relationship to members of her family. In writing, as her mother was dying and ultimately passed away, how she found peace and a place of healing for herself and many women in her immediate family. Plus, the Black women writers she says have carried her to where she is now, and why she says she had to leave the classroom 7 years before retirement after giving her love to students for free. That and more is next when Black and Published continues. And just a note, during this episode, I forgot to ask Ms. Honoree to read from her collection because I was so engrossed in the conversation. Charge it to my head, not my heart, y'all. Now, let's get to the episode. Last we spoke, you talked about after Love Songs, you were working on essays, you were working on short stories, and maybe something from Miss Lucille. In reading Misbehaving at the Crossroads, my true first question now for you is, did you have to write Love Song before you could be able to write this version of Misbehaving at the Crossroads?
Oh, yeah. Love Songs, I mean, so it's really interesting when you do these events, and I didn't do a lot of in-person events for Love Songs because we were in the middle of the pandemic, okay? But I was at AWP in 2023, and I developed a lot of social anxiety during the pandemic. I've always been socially awkward, and I've always had anxiety, but I could mask a lot better. Now, I just let people know, listen, don't be grabbing on me. You know, allow me to pull you in, right? So I was at AWP after I'd won the National Book Critics Circle. And this lady came up to me, white lady came up to me, and she didn't mean any harm. And so she comes up to me with no kind of introduction as she goes, "You're Ailey, and your sister Cece is Coco, and your sister Val is Lydia." And I said, "Hey, how are you?" "I'm honored." And so she just keeps going on. And I said, "Liz, whatever business of mine you know, is what I'm going to tell you on the stage." I don't have deep personal discussion with people I don't know. Now, I get into really deep things when I'm on these conversations, right? But that's because I volunteer them. I am a deep Southern woman of, as the French say, d'un certain âge, okay, of a certain age. And so home training is very important to me. Okay, manners are very important to me. And so, you know, I've had people ask the very intrusive questions and with the glow up, as it were, with love songs, I've had to learn how to be gracious and stuff. But when I was a poet only, I would just say to people, you don't know me well enough to ask that question. Mama was real good at the jail people too. You and Don are not in the same catechism club. What that meant, I have no idea. Mama had a million of them and her daddy did too. That's who she got it from, right? So why am I bringing this up? I'm bringing it up because in a real way, misbehaving lets people know this is the truth. So if you're seeking family secrets and love songs, you are going to be very disappointed. I do think, and here's where I get into a tiny flex, people don't truly know what I'm working with. Okay. I think the critics knew, right? Which is why Love Songs won the National Book Critics Circle Award, especially as the year progressed. Okay. The critics knew, oh, this is a deep intellect we are witnessing. Okay. But I think because I do have a regular sister affect, and it's not even an affect. This is who I am. Jericho Brown is also a very dear friend, the poet. And we talk about it all the time because Jericho is from Louisiana, right? He's from Shreveport. But Jericho has that little patina of, you know, like he's grilled to the accent a bit. But me, and we were talking about it, and I said, Jericho, I just don't have time to do everything that I need to do, to read all the books that I need to read, to write all the things, and to be trying to make sure that I sound all proper so the white peoples with an S. I ain't got time, but I don't give a damn. Think I'm smart, not think I'm smart. Here's the 800-page book. Voila. Now leave me alone. But there is this sort of attitude that you really have to perform as a Black woman for people to see you as smart. But as I tell people all the time, my foremothers paid the price, right? I don't have to do that anymore to prove it. So, yeah, so I would look at misbehaving as a companion, right? So if people want to see what the real life, personal and public history is, and then they can see what I did with it in Love's. So, for example, there are three sisters in Love. My sister Val did have substance abuse issues. But when Val passed away, God rest her soul, in 2023, she'd been sober for 30 years, which was someone who has struggled with eating issues on and off my entire life, like I would say food addiction. I'm just going to keep it real. To know that Val just cold turkey stopped drinking, stopped doing drugs, like that is incredible to me. Mama stopped smoking cold turkey, and Mama had substance abuse issues too. And I didn't even really realize that until right before she was dying. So that when she said, I don't remember, I was like, she really didn't remember. Now, then we can go into, well, she shouldn't have been using drugs and blah, 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 blah. But having been in a marriage, which I try to give my ex-husband privacy, I don't use his name, you know, I've changed his name in the book. But having been in a very bad marriage where somebody was getting on my last damn nerves, I can understand, because I gained weight when I took up running. It's very meditative, but I turned to food when he was who he was. So, yes, to get back to misbehaving, there is no one-to-one correlation. Yes, there's substance abuse, obviously, with Lydia and Leslie. And I grew up watching substance abuse that was far more polite, right? You know, mama had prescribed opiate. And a lot of people don't know that the number one drug addict is a middle-class white woman. So while they're busy talking about fentanyl coming over, I'm like, honey, you need to be going to Miss Lady's doctor and telling her to stop giving her, you know, this, this, that, and the third, right? So I grew up with polite drug abuse. And then my sister Val became an alcoholic, and there was just all kinds of drama with that. And then everything fell to Mama, and she then, to a lesser extent, to Cece, my middle sister, and me. But nobody has ever said thank you. And I didn't do a good job. I'll tell you that right now. I was a teenager. I was in my early 20s. But it is interesting that no one ever said thank you to Cece, who did far more than I did when the kids were little. And no one ever said thank you to me. And people just kind of took it for granted that Mama was going to come in there and take over. And she did.
I asked the question about, did you have to write one to write this? Just because, like, I finished the essays and I was like, I should go back and reread Love Songs. Just because you a deeper understanding of the historical pieces that you were getting at. And so, like, this essay collection, you open with January 6th, and then you have a chapter in there about how the creation of the abusive character, the sexually abusive character in the novel, in the enslaved portion of the book, was truly based off of Thomas Jefferson. And I was like, what?
Yeah. And, you know, the only reason I felt comfortable saying that is that he's dead. You can't defame the dead. But it was Thomas Jefferson. I have really obsessed about him and this kind of way that he had unchecked power. And then not only did he have unchecked power, but now we see that with Black men in our community as well. But not only did Thomas Jefferson have unchecked power, then what you had is people continually throughout the years after he died, sanitized, right? There's something that happened in Monticello where there was a passageway between Thomas Jefferson's room and Sally Hemings' room, and they like walled it up or whatever. So when we look at Annette Gordon Reed, she went back in there and she reclaimed a lot. The only issue I have, and I really, really, really respect that sister, is that should be obvious to all of us that that was child molestation. Why don't we call, as Miss Aretha sang, let's call this song exactly what it is. What it is, what it is, what it is child molestation. So yeah, Thomas Jefferson, like I think about him a lot. I thought about him a lot when I was writing The Age of Phyllis, my fifth book of poetry. And only that one piece made it in, but I wrote like several other pieces because I always think about unchecked power. I think about how my mother protected my father, continued to protect his legacy after he died. That's actually one of the reasons I stopped going to the family reunion, stopped visiting her, stopped talking to relatives because they would sit up and they would say these wonderful things about my dad. Now, I've forgiven my dad, but there's a difference. I don't have the beautiful memories of my father the way that I do Mama. Mm. And maybe it's because with your mom, you share her blood. You are flesh of her flesh. She breastfed. That's as close to God as you can, you know, and I try to tell people that even though I am a child-free woman, I revere mothers because I used to tell my students, there is a thin scream between life and death when you are giving birth to a child. So there is a difference. Even though we had a lot of problems and she hurt me, and yes, I would say, I mean, she neglected me. You know, neglect is abuse. But there is a difference because everything that I am is because of mom. Her language, her connection to the land, everything. You know, people, and it really used to make me really mad. People would say, well, you got your smarts from your father. I beg your pardon. Early childhood education came from my mama, right? And my mother taught my sister Val to read. My sister Val taught me to read. My mother's mother, who was something else, she taught mama to read. So even though her father was like, supposedly this really great guy, and they all adored him. There is something to be said of that matrilon, you know. But to return to Thomas Jefferson, when I think about him, I think about the way that nobody really cared about Sally Hemings except Annette Gordon Reed. What it was we only cared about her because of her connection to him. But when we say things like, he built Monticello, say, well, he didn't build a damn thing. Okay, now, he may have designed the architecture because he wanted a genius, but everybody surrounding him kept him alive. And many of those people were Black women. And so when we think about that, we think about, who's cooking his food? He's growing his food probably outside of the kitchen house, right? Who's taking care of his kid while he's away doing his political thing, all right? Who's doing all of that? Who's nurturing this environment? That is the invisible labor of Black women. And so when I began thinking about that, I began thinking about enslaved Black women and how so much of us is ignored. And then I started connecting that to myself. I remember teaching, and come August the 1st, I will have retired 7 years early because I got tired of loving on these kids, most of whom were white, and they're taking my love and my care for granted. I remember 10 years ago, I was in the classroom. Now, this was a young Black guy. He's biracial. And I made the mistake of calling him brother. And so one day, he came to me after class. He was standing over me. And he said, I don't like when you call me brother. And I said, well, I'm sorry. I just thought, you know, because you were Black. And he said, I'm not Black. I'm biracial. And I wanted to say, that hair of yours ain't biracial, babe, because ain't nobody pulling nay fine tooth comb through there. Okay? Ain't nobody pulling a fine tooth comb through my hair, and my hair was straighter than his, if you catch my drift. So he went through this whole thing, and I said, well, you know, darling, I used to say baby, darling, whatever. I had to stop doing that because creepy male professors, you know, so I had to stop with all of the little sweet thing. But that was back in the before time. I said, baby, well, I'm sorry. You should have just said something. We're in the last month of the semester. You could just say it. Professor Jeffers, you make me uncomfortable. I would have not said anything. Mm-hmm. But then as I'm wont to do, I went home and I started thinking about it. I'm a thinking person. And when I came back to that class, and that was a very difficult class because that class took place when our now current president was running for his first term. And the kids pick up. That's another reason I had to stop teaching. They kick things up. And they're kids. Okay? But I came back to class, the next class period. And I said, let me tell y'all something. I have to treat you politely and perhaps even kind. And I have to make sure that you know this information. I said, but the love come for free. I said, don't ever think that I'd have a responsibility to love you. I don't even care if you were a little kid. I don't have a responsibility to love you. I love you because of my humanity. And I saw them kind of like kids, like, what is happening? I said, so when you come up in here talking any kind of way to me, because there were other people that done this, I said, let me tell you something. I could say something that would ruin your self-esteem because I watch you all. I said, but it's because I watch you that I can love you so strong and always be aware that there is a choice that I make to love you. And girl, he looked at me and he was like, and I'm looking at him like, yeah, Negro. Yeah. You know, don't. And so that is what I thought about with mama, like the kind of stuff that people took for granted. And it took me a really long time, sister, to understand this. That I just thought, oh, this is individual. People are treating me this way. I just have to work harder. I have to be grittier. I have to dress better. I've got to beat my face. And I just kept, you know, working harder to be grittier, to be better, to be this, this, that, and the other. Fortunately, even though I'm of a particular age, I'm holding up. Oh, but that's what I thought. I thought, oh, you know, I've just got to be better. But then I realized this is an ancestral thing. We're never going to be better.
And that's what you do in the book. You weave the colorism, the history of the United States, your own personal story, and all of these different essays and poems and vignettes that you have. And it's all through your Black feminist womanist lens, right? And so when I get to chapter 19 and you say, as a woman, I was under the impression that I could achieve out of sexism and misogyny, as you just kind of talked about trying to put yourself together to be better. When did you stop believing that?
So when Ma was dying, I was surrounded by people who sort of reached out that had been taught by Ma. And it was my alumni community. And I think really some of them may have reached out from the goodness of their heart, but others reached out because I had 6 degrees of separation between me and Uncle Lynn. Okay. I kept trying to tell people, Miss Oprah and I are not incredibly close friends. Right. Miss Gail don't have nothing to worry about. But you know, just the fact that I had spoken to her and whatever, I think that fooled some people. I think some people weren't being kind. But what I began to realize is these people that I had known when I was in college and different things like that, they didn't seem to understand I wasn't going to stop being offended. I am even more of a hardcore feminist now than I was back then. So what happened was, when all of this was going on with mom, and I would be around my family, people that I knew from back in the day, and they would say stuff, you know, kind of querying mood. And so I was like, did it still be because I have good credit now that I don't believe in the equality of women, in particular Black women? And that is when, and believe me, it came as a shock to me that at the age of 56, and I was like, oh, people thought I was a feminine because I didn't know how to fix myself up because I couldn't get no man. And not to be funny, I not only could get my own man, I had some other people's men and they don't know of me.
What?
Like, oh, sweetie, I could tell you some things, okay? So there was this sort of attitude like, you can't get no man, you know, you're not in a sorority, you don't know how to dress, you don't know how to fix yourself up, blah, blah, blah. One of the things that's really funny is age is the great equalizer. We all grow and we all change, but I think it was Maya Angelou, Dr. Angelou, who said something like, some people just get older and then other people get wise. And so what I was realizing is a lot of these people assumed again that I was a feminist because I was a Now here I am, have a much better credit score. I am doing pretty well with my vocation as a writer. I had all the attention I ever thought I would want and then some. To be honest, I really don't want some of the attention I'm getting. And I'm like, I have everything. And I have peace. I am reconciled with my lover. I no longer wake up saying, why did that happen to me in my chair? I no longer feel dirty. I no longer feel ashamed. And here I am still believing in feminine. And so that's when I began to understand that I have become my own elder. It's a scary thing. It's scary.
Why?
To know that, because as Miss Lucille once wrote, there is a girl inside. Like when people encounter me and they've seen my work and my work is so serious, and then they encounter me and I'm so playful, you know, and goofy. Sometimes I'll be on the phone with my friends. They're like, girl, I'm crazy, you know. But when you do go to these very, very dark, painful, sometimes bloody, you know, tragic, like it's, you want to shake that off, you know. And I do. I have joy, which I never thought of. Because when I talked to you last time, I didn't have joy. I felt seen. Like I always say, first we thank God, and then we thank Miss Oprah. You know, this Black woman made me seen. She made me seen. And she let everybody see me. And I think people were like, wow, this is a really serious book for the Oprah Book Club, you know. But I think people need to know what Miss Oprah is working with too. No. But she made me sing. And so that was something I never felt. I never felt seen. Mm-hmm. You know, when I'd been a poet, people would sort of treat me like, oh, you just sort of emoted your way. The Angelus. There were early Americanists who were really treating me like, you know, I wasn't really smart. I won't call no name. But you can't come up with an 800-page novel. Kind of like, wait a minute. I'm like, oh, you didn't know what I was working with, you know. But not only that, you didn't know what my ancestors who never went to grade school were working. That's what people don't really understand, you know. We're here because of their real.
So then how do you grapple with the precarity of being a Black writer in this privileged writing space, this rarefied air, so to speak, but you're writing about Black people who are inherently valuable and worthy of study and illustration and art?
Because other Black women fought me to do. That's why whenever you see my book, you see gesture to other Black women. You know, my mama, Trilly Lee James Jeffers, right? Alice Walk, Pauline Morris, Stine Sanchez, Lucille Clifton. You see me gesturing towards scholars like Jennifer L. Morgan, Neil Irvin Painter, Beverly Gashetal. So you see me gesturing. These women carried me. And I'm very aware of. I am very aware that these women carried me to this place. And again, when I say I've become my own elder, now I have to do that for my babies, though. Because I want more for my babies, though. I don't, what is really grieving me is to see this same sort of ugliness coming sometimes for Black women that I saw when I was in high school or whatever. I never thought we'd be here. But as my mama can say, as long as my head is hot, I'm going to keep doing this for my baby sisters, because I want better for them, because they deserve it. They deserve it, and our foremothers deserve it, because they did the work for us to get it. People prayed for us for this time that they couldn't even conceive. But yes, I get very terrified. I'm not as terrified as I am because now that people do know what I'm capable of, what they know is this woman does have a brain. This woman does terrible means. But I will tell you that I am always encountering white people who are very disappointed that I do not perform racial reconciliation. That is not my answer. To be trying to make white folks comfortable, trying to reconcile with white people, because white supremacy is not a self-inflicted wound. It's not for us to do the work for them anymore. There were all kinds of books that came out in 2020 during the Black Lives Matter. And here we are. You know, I'm not interested in healing America. I'm not interested in racial reconciliation. I am interested in the health of my people. I am now in my selfish place. I did work for years, for over two decades, trying to reach to white people, to love them, to cherish them. I have put countless hours of mentoring into young white kids. I've done my time. I feel the same way about black men. I've done my time.
I wish we could see you laughing at me.
Oh, that I done. I have given money. I have given tail. I have made biscuits and cornbread and fried chicken. I have been nice to young me and mama. I have done it all. It is not my ministry anymore to do that. I am concerned about me, my sister, and their children. Male, female, whatever gender. That is my concern.
The reason I laugh is because you have the chapter in the book about the woman at the training that you were at that was early in the morning.
And that's a short story in the case. So it didn't really happen.
Okay. It didn't happen to you, but it happened to me. I have been at that 7:30 DEI training with those people. So it's my...
but well, I've been at one of those places.
Yeah.
Right? I've been in those. But when I say it's an imaginary letter, because I didn't have the courage to say those things. You understand? This is all in my mind. Like what I wish I said. What I wish, you know.
And I relate to that because like the things that I wish I said when I was in certain work settings when I used to work in television, or the things I'd wish I said when I was still married. And you're talking about you've completed your ministry. And like you talk about toward the end of the book, you say, I had begun to heal, had begun to find peace, something I never thought possible. But it had occurred to me that her whole life, my mother never had space to heal. Do you feel like that, and I don't want to be too personal, but I'm gonna step right here, that one of the reasons that maybe you never had children and made that choice for yourself is that in everything that you've seen in your generational line, especially your matrilineal line, you were finally the end to a so-called generational curse and were doing the healing so that you could be your own elder?
Yes. I mean, first of all, when you care for children that aren't yours, and nobody, even my mother, ever said thank you. My sister never said thank you. And I didn't do a great job or even a good job. So let's be very clear, okay? But, you know, mama would be, I did this to her, which is one of the reasons when I got in my 20s, I stopped taking money from her, asking her for stuff. But I remember mama would be standing in the middle of that kitchen as she would be going on. Come out of the bath, out of the car. You know, she would just, and how many of us have seen them lose bubble, you know? And she would be screaming and hollering, and I would just be like, she gonna get past me, and I'm gonna get everything. That's how selfish I was. And then when I got into like my early 30s, but even before then, I stopped taking money from her because I was like, these people are taking advantage of mom. And there were people, you know, who would talk about what daddy did. And I'm thinking, but that's still no excuse for you to be using her, for you to be taking all her money. you know, and then I realized that now that I'm on the other side, I have crossed the River Jordan into true womanhood. I realized, like, Val didn't have space. Mama didn't have space to heal. CC didn't have space to heal. Nobody had space to heal. And there were people in my family looking at me like I was selfish and I was a bad person. And maybe I was a bad person, and I certainly was selfish. But then I realized I couldn't do for Mama at the end of her life. I couldn't have done that, paying $8,000 a month out of my savings, if I had not made those choices, right? If I hadn't gone into therapy, you know, I mean, I really worked on myself. And, you know, people used to shame me for not having. But I couldn't be doing right now. And, you know, there's some place in the Bible where it says something like, you're not supposed to talk about, you know, specific of when you give charity, right? But I'm speaking for so many other, you know, child-free Black women. I mean, we give money don't nobody even know about. And I will be real, real old-fashioned and be someplace and see a young Black person and I'll be like, let me bless you, baby. And not, oh, let me bless you. And they'd be like, man, I'm like, let me bless you. Don't block my blessing by blessing you, okay? I don't let people force me or guilt me. I don't do it. I do it because the Lord puts it on my heart. But yeah, sister, I clawed that space for heal. I fought for that space of heal. I mean, I was throwing blows for 30-something years to get that space. And people don't want you to have that space. They'll sit up and they'll talk about what a good woman you was at your funeral and this, this, that, and the third. But they won't talk about how, you know, somebody dumped their kids on you to raise. When my mama died, she didn't have a dime to her neck. That is not any kind of virtue. And that people are looking at me. And if it hadn't been me coming in with my checkbook, what would have happened? And that, to me, was confirmation that the Lord was saying to me, remember all this time late in the midnight hour, you had that shame. And people were shamed. They would call me up and they'd be like, when the Bible said, shaming. And I remember when I came to the little town that Mama had lived in set up camp. And there were these complete strangers that I met. And they would say, you're here now. The rest doesn't matter. And that carried me, right? And then I remember the night Mama died. And I didn't put that in the book. It was too devastating. She had begged me not to leave. But sister, I was so tired. I mean, I was tired. And I said, Mama, I'll be back tomorrow. And I remember I was on that country road. It was pitch black. It was an hour's drive. And all of a sudden, I was in the car. And I felt this huge boulder slip from me. I felt so light. And they called me 90 minutes later and told me she had passed. And I was screaming. And, you know, like one of those Black women of old, you know. And Mama hated that kind of stuff. Mama, ain't that damn I wear? Just I'm screaming. Right? Oh, I was screaming. But then later on that night, I heard her walking around. It was weird. And I knew that she was with me. And someone that I know is a Yoruba priest. And he said to me that the ancestors are still healing in the act. And so I knew I had done the right. Even when my family was acting all shady at home going, you know, they went stay for the repaying. Because, you know, they wanted me putting my foot And they thought that this end of the life drama about mama would put me in my place, but it really, it felt like mama had called me to her so that I could run. And I promised her, you know, I promised her spirit after that homegoing, I was gonna be the woman that she wanted to be, that she didn't have the space to be. I said, I'm gonna do the good things that she did, you know, give to people, help people with their kids, all of that. I was gonna do the good thing. And then I was gonna do what she never was able to do.
And you say at the end of the book, you say, you know, I'm still Trellie Lee's misbehaving child.
I'm still Trellie Lee's misbehaving. And that was the thing, like, you know, she would get mad at me because I wouldn't do what she wanted me to do. But she always told me to be a rebel. Mm-hmm. She always encouraged me to be a rebel. You know, she always did. She would say, you know, don't let these people grind you down.
So with everything that you shared about your story today in misbehaving and even the parts that are coded in fiction and love songs, what do you want readers, yes, but specifically young Black women to take from this years of work and healing and understanding from your story?
That you are not alone. You are not alone. I see you. I support you. And if you ever need reassurance, come back to this book.
Mm-hmm. Big thank you to Ms. Honoree Fanone-Jeffers for being here today on Black and Published. You can follow Honoree on the socials at Honoree_Jeffers on Instagram and Black Library Girl on Blue Sky. And make sure you check out Misbehaving at the Crossroads, Essays and Writings. It's out now from Harper. You can get a copy of the book from Mahogany Books and get 10% off your first purchase using code BLACKPUB at checkout. That's BLKPUB. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Honoree about the unbreakable connection between women's equality and love as our birthright. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be James Stewart III, author of Defiant Acts.
I've come from a family that's incredibly supportive, a home that was incredibly loving, in a world, in a system where that is actively discouraged. And this is something that I think when I started to write these stories, that was coming through, that this care, this solidarity, that is what kept me coming back to the page, that kept me returning to these characters, that kept me returning to the city.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.
What's going on, family? This is Derek Young.
And Ramonda Young.
Owners of both Mahogany Books and the Mahogany Books Podcast Network.
We really want to thank each and every one of you for listening to this episode. And if you enjoyed what you just heard, drop us a review and rate us on whatever platform you download podcasts on.
We truly appreciate each and every one of you for supporting us and making us your go-to for Black books. And we look forward to connecting with you all sometime in the future.
Thank you again, fam. And always remember, Black books matter.